This week on The Futurists, Roman Yampolsky.
We are gambling with all of humanity for potential monetary benefits. It's not even obvious what the gamble is.
Well, welcome back to The Futurists. I'm Robert Tursik, and my co-host Brett King is joining me. Hi, Brett.
Hey.
Good to see you again on the road, my friend.
Yeah, good to have another show on AI and dive into what's happening and debate it with a knowledgeable expert. So I always enjoy this. It's also one of the ways I learn as a host is
that's right.
You know, having these amazing guests talking about this leading edge stuff. It's a really privileged position.
You know, we hear so much about artificial intelligence in almost every corner of business these days. And it's always with a kind of giddy euphoria. People are very excited about it. Certainly in Silicon Valley, the investors are drunk on artificial intelligence at this point. Yeah. So the valuations are very high. There's a lot of enthusiasm there. Finally, after a decade of trying to find something to replace the smartphone, the investors seem to have settled on artificial intelligence as the next big thing. So that's very exciting. I live in Hollywood, where, of course, the reaction is the exact opposite, where we've got the screenwriters and the producers and the directors are sitting there with their arms crossed going, no way, no how, we're against it completely. So you've got this polarization. Right in the middle of that is room for a voice of reason, someone to say, hang on, before we go rushing ahead into the future, maybe we should think twice about some of this. And of course, who better to talk about that than our friend, Dr. Roman Yampolsky. Roman Yampolsky, welcome back to the show.
Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. You should get AI to do introductions. I'm sure it will get it right the first time.
Let me tell the folks who are listening about your background. So Roman is an associate professor of computer science and engineering at the Speed School of Engineering at the University of Louisville. He's also the author of several books, and one of them is a very important book we're going to talk about today, his latest book, Unexplainable, Unpredictable, and Uncontrollable. But he's also the author of more than 200 other academic publications, and he's been cited more than 1,000 times by other researchers because his particular field of study is AI safety. And Roman, I wanted to start with that. Tell us what you mean when you say AI safety, because I think a lot of people assume that technology is safe. What does it need a safety study for?
So almost everyone working in AI works on capabilities research, making AI more capable of performing as well as a human, outperforming humans. But if you think about having this agent with such level of capability, it's important to make sure whatever it does is beneficial to us, we're happy about it. And that's essentially what safety is all about, making sure those robots or agents behave, they align in terms of their preferences and accomplishments with the owner, the user, whoever we decide is relevant to those systems.
And the field of AI safety has been, in the last year, it's kind of leaped to the forefront of some folks' imagination in the sense that there's been so much controversy around these AI chatbots like ChatGPT, which on the one hand, they seem quite trivial, but the enthusiasts say, oh no, this is a step towards a artificial general intelligence. And so we're on this path towards building a super intelligence that's smarter than human beings. First of all, when you hear that, what is your response to that? How do you respond when you hear people talk about super intelligence and ChatGPT being a step towards that?
So that's really interesting. Today, with existing models, take something like Claude 3, people basically will argue that it's already artificial general intelligence. It has IQ of 101. It outperforms average human in most domains. And then you'll hear people say, oh, it's just a stupid chatbot. It just parrots back, a few sentences. So that's already something we should be concerned about. We don't even properly assess existing technology, yeah, much less what is coming in a year or two. And many of us believe if same level of progress continues, we'll get to what we call superintelligence in that time frame.
You know, it's interesting. I think this is a trend, not just in artificial intelligence, but generally. Look at the way we've treated climate change. You know, there are still people arguing that climate, we don't know if it's real and so forth. We spend so much time debating if or whether, you know, it's going to happen, that we don't actually prepare for the inevitability. Because, you know, the amount of investment that's going into artificial intelligence right now, we're going to get there. Like, it's pretty much guaranteed. That's what the market wants. So we should be doing better work on preparing how AI integrates into society, just as we should have been doing much better work preparing on how to defend humanity against climate change. But this debate about whether or not it's going to happen, it just seems like such a useless pursuit. You know, it seems so counterproductive.
Well, and probably part of it is by design, right? Because some folks have a very strong interest in paralyzing people with inaction and causing them to, you know, debate endlessly so that no precautions are put in place or no regulations are put down preemptively. Roman, tell us your perspective on that.
So I know people who are respected scholars who argue it's impossible to create AGI. We'll never get there. At the same time, we have people who are saying, you know, 2 years from now, we're going to have AGI. And those are heads of leading labs, whatever it's OpenAI, Anthropic. Those are the predictions. I think NVIDIA CEO, is it like 5 years? Prediction markets are like 7. So it doesn't matter. All of them are basically saying it's happening very, very soon.
Yes.
What do you have to contribute to superintelligence? And I'm not sure we have good answers. More importantly, after publishing this book, I'm arguing that there are no answers.
And the book title says it all. The book is called AI, Unexplainable, Unpredictable, Uncontrollable. That's about as pessimistic an assessment of artificial intelligence as you could hope for, and in one short title.
It's realistic. Jan LeCun commented on it. He said, that's amazing. You have 3 mistakes in one title. And I just said, amazing, Jan LeCun, Turing Award winner. I shortened the blurb.
That's great. But to some extent, that's true. I mean, you could say, you can take a look at ChatGPT today and say, gee, it demonstrates emergent behavior, things like writing software code, something that wasn't programmed into it. That's emergent behavior. We couldn't predict that. And then there's also the tendency to hallucinate, that despite all the efforts they're putting in to kind of train these models and correct them and micro train them or, you know, fine tune them, they still hallucinate from time to time. And you can also deceive them, right? You can hypnotize the chatbots. So even though these are, let's say, rudimentary compared to what we think will come with superintelligence, you can already see some of the flaws that you've outlined in your book in these public-facing consumer-grade AI services. Do you think that any of the problems I just said can be solved?
Well, I haven't found many solutions. AI safety is so far all about discovering different types of problems. And capabilities work is basically scaling what we have. So if we add more compute, more data, we'll have a more capable system. The work is easy, just fundraise. For safety work, we have to find really brilliant novel approaches. And so far, we haven't really done that. And I think perhaps it's because you can't. So let's look at how we test software. In a narrow domain, I would look at edge cases. Does it work for 0? Does it work for very large number? Does it work for, I know what it's supposed to do and I can test for those weird conditions. For a general system performing across all possible domains, inventing novel approaches, how do you even test it? How do you know it's working properly? How do you know it will not, you know, perform what is known as treacherous turn later? It worked fine today, but later it realized based on self-improvement, new learning, that it actually should be doing something else. It's not part of existing testing protocol. So I'm not optimistic about our ability to create perfectly safe software with such level of capability. But in order to do it right, we have to have a perfectly safe, super intelligent software. Otherwise, because of its capability, a single bug can cause existential crisis. And that's the difference between cybersecurity today and superintelligence alignment. In cybersecurity, you screw up, we'll give you a new credit card, we'll reissue passwords, everything's fine. Maybe somebody gets embarrassed. Here, you only get one chance to get it right.
Yeah,
that's an area of major concern. One of the points you make in the book is that when you're doing cybersecurity, you have to protect the entire system, where a hacker, a malicious user, only has to find one vulnerability. So there's a real asymmetry in the challenges that both are facing. And with general intelligence or an artificial intelligence of sufficient caliber, you're talking about an infinite attack surface that the attacker has an infinite number of opportunities to find a weakness or a flaw. And that is, by definition, an impossible defense posture.
It's actually harder than that. So 10 years ago, when I started working on it, a lot of work was on how do we make sure it never gets connected to internet? How do we make sure it never has access to humans for social engineering attacks? Now, standard approach is to connect it to internet, give access to everyone, and then open source the code. How do you protect from malevolent actors? So once you, even if you're successful somehow at making a friendly system, immediately somebody can modify the system. They have access.
Mm-hmm. Particularly if it's open source. Apparently there are 500,000 open source language models now on Hugging Face.
Probably
the number has gone up since the time that I read about that, but it seems to me that that's another source of an infinite number of combinations that any one of which could lead to a problem.
Roman, and I don't want to go off in a I want to stick to the book as much as we can, but I am intrigued as a researcher, where do you think that quantum fits into this problem set? Because it appears to me it could complicate things. Quantum computing could complicate, but could also potentially solve some of these issues.
So it looks like we don't really need to have quantum computers to get to AGI. It seems like standard von Neumann architecture gets us there. If we do get it, it will probably expedite the process of training those models. It will definitely impact existing crypto security protocols. We can read previously encrypted messages. We can break crypto economy based on existing protocols. I don't see how it helps safety that much. If anything, it complicates things. We don't fully understand quantum, so my unexplainable part will become fundamentally stronger. But at best, it expedites everything.
Take us through the premise. Let's start with the controllability problem. I would think that the people who are developing AI right now feel it's fully under control. If there's a problem with it, if it's a runaway piece of software, unplug the machine or disconnect it from the web, there, problem solved. How do you respond to that?
So we can talk about different levels of control, different degrees. Not running it, not turning it on is one option, but you're really not getting any benefit out of a system. If you're running it, we know that it gets jailbroken daily. Every day somebody finds a new way to sneak malicious commands into it. Maybe they'll use ASCII art. Maybe they'll use, multiple levels of text encoding with some subliminal messaging for the system. But it's a guarantee. Basically, if the large language model is refusing to do something for you, rephrase your request in a different way, and there is always a way to get it to do what you want. What they're doing right now is, and I think the image on the cover of the book is a perfect illustration of that. They have this base model, this monster, which is really ill-behaved. And what they're really doing is putting filters on it, putting mm-hmm. lipstick on a pig. They're making it more palatable to investors, never say this word, never talk about this topic. But under the hood, it's the same model. It just has more filters on top of it. So we're not making it safer. We're doing a better job of filtering out bad outputs.
Right. We've seen that. I think not too long ago, someone revealed the system prompts for, I think it was ChatGPT. There are more than 1,000 tokens used in system prompts. And these are basically instructions that say, don't talk about celebrities, don't talk about famous people, don't talk about anything that's offensive. So it's kind of telling the machine what not to do as it formulates a response, as it generates a response to the prompt. But that strikes me as really a threadbare defense, because it's like holding up a piece of newspaper in front of a machine gun. How are you going to prevent someone from finding holes or shooting holes in that?
And again, once you open source it, they'll just remove any of those filters if they want to, or replace them with different ones.
Yeah, exactly.
The folks who are developing these technologies, and you mentioned that Jan LeCun, who's famous for being kind of snarky, you mentioned that he made a snarky comment about your book. How do other AI researchers at the big technology companies, how do they respond to your work? Do they welcome it? Do they support it? Do they resist it? Do they debate with you?
Again, there is so much diversity in how people receive this message. Some say, well, of course we're not going to control superintelligence. It's obvious. It's laughable that someone can suggest we can. Others say, well, yeah, we're going to have no problems because something so smart will be by nature very well-mannered and like us and try to create utopia for us. So it's all those extremes without any scientific justification. What does the game theory say? What are the previous examples of, you know, AI accidents? So it's really as diverse as you can think. Thousands of different people with thousands of takes on this.
I mean, philosophically speaking, I can sort of come to the conclusion that, you know, AI is a logic machine. It's built on code. It's going to, you know, as that sort of core of the way we've built artificial intelligence, that it wouldn't do things that would be negative to humanity and so forth. It'd generally be positive because that's the most logical approach for a machine to take. But then again, we've trained all these AIs on human reasoning and human logic. So, you know, I'm not sure that holds, but I see the conflict. I see that disparity of thought. Because if you are designing a pure logic machine, then logically that, you know, AI, the outcome of that is going to act in, you know, the best logical interests of everybody involved. But
That's a pretty hefty assumption, though.
I know, because, but that's the problem, I mean, right?
It's that's optimized to, designed to optimize resource management, it might look at human beings as a kind of viral overgrowth that's consuming too much resource.
Yeah. Well, that would be logical, right? So that's the conflict. And then you know, humanity, you know, we are not at all logical. Well, we are, you know, try to be
at all. No, that's it. The data that these systems are trained on is created by humans, exactly. And we're completely irrational.
So, given that level of uncertainty, the fact that we aren't putting in more fundamental guardrails seems to be an issue. Roman, I mean, I've been watching the debates on the whole ethical constraints and so forth. You know, we've talked about, I think even on the last interview we had with you, talked about, you know, Google and Microsoft, you know, attempting to sort of build these ethical boards and those guys being increasingly shut out and so forth. But, you know, you talk about these tokenized elements of the guardrails. But is there a more structured approach we could take to sort of building sort of an ethical subroutine for artificial general intelligence and superintelligence that could give us a basis of safer operation, do you think?
So you bring up logical machines. This was the approach in like 70s where we tried to use just, okay, standard logic and this is
right,
the
expert
axioms
systems,
you're going to get and this is the output. We stopped using that approach long time ago. It didn't scale, didn't work. So we switched to this machine learning approach where we throw data at it and it learns whatever it learns. So we don't have a lot of control over what it's actually thinking or doing. The next level would be, okay, let's add guardrails to it based on some sort of ethical framework, but we don't agree on ethics.
Right.
That's exactly the reason why we fight the wars, why we have different, you know, political parties hating on each other. For millennia, philosophers, ethicists tried to come up with something universal, and we kind of failed at it. So even if we knew how to program it in, which we don't, even if we knew how to limit it from later modifying and removing those guardrails, which we don't really agree on the values we want to instill. The value alignment problem is ill-defined. We don't talk about whose values.
Yeah.
We don't talk about how to get 8 billion people to be in agreement. And of course, again, what stops the system from going, I will learn from first principles what makes sense. You told me to play the game of Go. This is what I should be doing. But I deleted your knowledge, did some self-play, and now I'm a superior Go player, not relying on human knowledge. It would do the same with ethics and morals. I mean, your rules are kind of changing and you're not sure. Let's discover it from first principles.
Interesting.
That's a frightening thought. So then on the other hand, there are people like, let's say, Marc Andreessen, the venture capitalist who wrote his Tech Optimist Manifesto. We've talked about that a little bit on previous episodes of this show. a very vigorous, if a little bit unhinged, kind of argument in favor of going full bore ahead, what some people refer to as accelerationism. And right. Just to summarize that briefly for our listeners, the concept there is don't waste time with the ethical debate. Don't waste time trying to figure out how to put guardrails in place. Don't spend the energy on that. Instead, we should embrace the concept of a superintelligence. Let's put the pedal to the metal and go as fast as we can and get to that superintelligence. Let's be the first to do it. Now, that sounds crazy the way I'm summarizing it, but there are actually people who fundamentally believe this. And to defend them, their perspective is that the benefits of a superintelligence are going to so greatly outweigh the risks. And, you know, Marc Andreessen goes on to say that, you know, lives will be saved. Human lives will be saved by superintelligence. And anyone who's resisting it, anyone who's slowing it down, is actually responsible for killing people. A little bit extreme, but that's literally what he says in the Tech Manifesto. How do you respond to the accelerationists?
So the mainstream belief is we are 2 years away, right? So how much acceleration do we need? Do we need it to Tuesday? Like, I'm not even sure what it is they're trying to save in terms of time. And again, if there is zero chance that it will have negative impact, it would make sense. But I think standard PDUM right now is like 30% for people working in it, meaning we are gambling with all of humanity for potential monetary benefits. It's not even obvious what the gamble is. So I'm very skeptical. It's interesting to observe that I think when Eliezer Yudkowsky was like 16, he had the same logic, same thinking. He was thinking we need to bring singularity as soon as possible. He started Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. And I think by like 17, he was finally realizing that's the stupidest idea you can possibly implement. And now all these people decades later coming along going, this is brilliant new accelerationist philosophy.
Right. Why did he determine it was stupid?
Because we don't know how to control those things. Right. The safety question quickly comes to the forefront. You don't understand what goes into the utility function.
Yeah, I mean, we broadly don't understand how it is as a species to deal with someone or an intelligence that's smarter than us. You know, we always depicted this in Hollywood movies as being the aliens coming down that were super intelligent. But here we are creating our own super intelligence that could undermine humanity, and we're not putting, you know, we're not thinking about those risks. So we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Futurists, and we're going to be back talking about more of the future of AI. Provoke Media is proud to sponsor, produce, and support The Futurists podcast. Provoke.fm is a global podcast network and content creation company with the world's leading fintech podcast and radio show, Breaking Banks. And of course, its spin-off podcasts, Breaking Banks Europe, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific, and the FinTech Five. But we also produce the official Finovate podcast, Tech on Reg, Emerge Everywhere, the podcast of the Financial Health Network, and Next Gen Banker. For information about all our podcasts, go to provoke.fm or check out Breaking Banks, the world's number one FinTech podcast and radio show.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Futurist with me, Rob Tursik, and my co-host, Brett King. And this week, we're talking to Dr. Roman Yampolsky, the author of Unexplainable, Unpredictable, Uncontrollable, and it is a book about artificial intelligence. Roman is a specialist in AI safety, in the field of AI safety, actually a pioneer in the field, and cited by more than 1,000 other scholars for his work in that field. Now, let's help our audience understand what you mean by the title of the book, Unexplainable, Unpredictable, Uncontrollable. Let's start with unexplainability, because this is the year we're starting to hear about XAI. What is XAI?
So most people would be surprised to realize that people creating those systems don't fully understand how they work. In fact, they mostly don't understand how they work or why. You have a very large network of nodes connected by weights. Those weights are updated in response to a lot of data being fed to them. But we can't really explain the whole picture. Sometimes, if we're lucky, we can look at one node, one neuron, and go, okay, this seems to be excited every time there is a human face in front of a camera. That's pretty much the state of the art right now in understanding how those systems work. If we do more research, maybe we can understand some clustering groups of nodes which work together, suppress or get excited together. But if you look at the whole picture, the only true explanation for what the model does is the model itself. All the weights contribute to the decisions, so you need to really understand the whole model to accurately understand what it's doing. The model is huge. It's not surveyable for humans, so that is out. The other alternative is to kind of compress an explanation to where it gives you top 10 reasons for why the decision is made. This is like lossy compression. Yeah, you're getting some useful information, but something is missing from that explanation. And that's the trade-off we have. Either we're given a just-so explanation like children are, or we cannot comprehend the whole model, the whole picture of what is happening there.
Now, from time to time, Brett and I are asked to give presentations or to do talks with different professional groups, organizations like banks and other institutions. Of course, they're all very interested in artificial intelligence. And this concept of explainable AI is one that has excited a great deal of interest in those groups because they are regulated organizations. And it seems to be fundamentally incompatible with regulation to have an unexplainable AI. And yet, banks are massive consumers of artificial intelligence, and they're in the process of deploying generative AI chatbot assistants right now. How can those two things be reconciled, the notion of a regulated industry deploying an unexplainable artificial intelligence?
Well, that's why I'm very skeptical of regulation. I have a paper on unmonitorability of AI, and that's exactly that. Anytime you pass regulation, you should be able to enforce it, monitor closely what is happening with those systems, what is the state of the art, what capabilities they have. But it doesn't seem like we can do that. We train a new model. It takes months of training, if not years sometimes. And then we need years to figure out what it's capable of. And we still discover new capabilities later on. So it is not a meaningful thing to say, we fully understand those models and we have this regulation on top of it. We're all pretending. So we do things like we run experiments. Okay, the last five times it worked. It made an accurate prediction. So now we're just going to trust it like an oracle and take its word as the word of God. And that's what happens. It gets grandfathered in as a proprietary black box, which has answers. So when we see nightmare scenarios in criminal justice system, in sentencing, in some medical research where this was done, and it's not a good way to do things.
Yeah,
that's right. There's plenty of evidence of that. We've referred previously in the show to Kathy O'Neill's book, Weapons of Math Destruction. Mm-hmm. And that's not even about artificial intelligence. Her book is simply about the use of algorithms and data to do analysis and to predict, you know, things like trustworthiness or creditworthiness. And then by extension, is that a person that you can do business with, or should you hire that person, or should you make a loan to that person? And what ends up happening inevitably is that the data itself is polluted with so much bias that those systems start to make recommendations that look scientific. They look like they're neutral, but in fact, they're informed by poison data or, you know, biased data, and the results are biased.
And then when you do get something that it works hard to eliminate bias, you then get complaints that it's a woke AI.
I mean, right. We saw that last week or 2 weeks ago with Gemini, where, you know, Google overcorrected, right? Show me a picture of, you know, a Viking, and it's a multicultural Viking.
Yes,
it was very creative. I thought it shows you how creative those systems can be. But yeah, they I think rightly got pilloried for that.
But I mean, I am grateful for their attempt to make things more inclusive and so forth. Yeah. And this whole wokeism thing, I worry that it's. It's just a control mechanism to reinforce poor behavior and biases that are in the system. But
yeah, they're trying to overcorrect for bias in the system. Yeah, but exactly. like Roman said a moment ago, but putting those guardrails up, those are so easily bypassed, right? The systems today, as rudimentary as they may be relative to super intelligence of the future, can already bypass those. So when the systems get more capable, those guardrails are going to be inadequate, I should think.
I mean, it does come back to the whole ethical question, but Roman, if you were building a testing mechanism, we debate the Turing test and so forth, but instead of testing for intelligence, if you were testing for safety, how would you build a test to ensure that these various AIs are safe?
So the paper behind me is Untestability of AI. It's finished and probably been accepted last week. The whole point is you can't. If the system continues to learn, continues to self-modify, you cannot make any guarantees about its future behavior. That's the treacherous turn problem. We see it with humans all the time, right? We develop lie detectors, we develop psychological profiling, religions, morals. At the end of the day, you still get something like Snowden. Just you cannot prevent it. Good or bad, the point is the system could not rely on one of its parts to be fully reliable.
Let's talk a little bit about unverifiability, because that seems like it's a related concept here. This notion that, you know, things emerge from these systems, and in a way, we tend to treat them. You said Oracle a moment ago, and I get that. That is how people look at this thing. It's sort of a magical black box. You ask it a question and give it a prompt, and it magically produces this result. Now, of course, it isn't magical, right? There is a system at work here, but we can't verify how it works. Tell me a little bit about that as a challenge from a safety perspective.
So when I talk about verification, I'm talking about verifying software, that it is implemented in a way designers, software engineers intended, or verifying mathematical proofs. Most people, when they hear terms like mathematical proof or even verified software, they think, you know, 100% guaranteed deal. Reality is most software has bugs. That's why our approach is to click yes, I agree to whatever consequences instead of releasing proper software. Or with mathematical proofs, we find bugs in pieces of proof which are hundreds of years old, where most of mathematics is now built on top of those earlier proofs. So there is no guarantee even with software verification. We can get more security, more guarantees, safer AI with more resources, more layers of confirmation, but we never get to 100. Let's say you get something which is right almost always, one in a billion mistake, but it makes billions of decisions every minute. You guarantee it's going to fail in a few minutes.
Yeah.
And this is what we have. There is no way to guarantee that a piece of software performs according to specs. Worse yet, then it's a general system. There are no specs. Specs are for narrow systems. So no one knows how to do verification for general domain systems.
And average users are being exposed to this technology right now. You know, for instance, Microsoft is rolling out AI Copilot to more than a billion users this year through all of their software products. And so I think it's safe to say that within a year or two, most users of the internet are going to be conditioned to talking to machines, having conversations with machines, and getting mostly reliable answers. And to my mind, this isn't so much about the artificial intelligence. This is about conditioning us to passively accept the results from these systems, even though they're filled with the flaws that you're describing. Would you see that as another kind of a danger here, that we become over-reliant on systems that we can't control or contain or understand?
Right. But I would make a very important distinction between different levels of danger. So all the things people are worried about right now, technological unemployment, copyright issues for art, false information, election manipulation, none of it gets everyone killed. It's annoying, it's problematic, it has consequences economically and so on. It's very different from X risk, existential risk, or suffering risk, which is the big problem we're worried about. And it used to be we talked about, you know, problems long-term, problems short-term. I think they might actually be flipping on us, because it takes many years to have full technological unemployment. To deploy humanoid robots may take a decade. Whereas we can develop superintelligence in 2-3 years. So they're no longer long-term, they're short-term problems, and they are the big ones. I am less worried about every other aspect of it, misinformation, deep fakes, all of it is kind of annoying, but again, we're not going to die from it.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the legal ramifications of this. One of the chapters of your book talks about AI personhood And, you know, you just talked about technology and employment and so forth. And, you know, this sort of flows into this, the role that AI is going to play in society and the legal role that AI will play in society. We don't really... well, we do have some analogies, I guess, of personhood and rights, as the, even just the debate on, you know, treatment of transgender people and so forth, you know, is a question of personhood, you could argue. But it appears to me that we are going to have to identify who the AI is that has made a decision in if something happens, that someone is killed or some negative impact. How do we, first of all, sign decisions and interactions made with specific AI so we can identify the source of the artificial intelligence that made that decision that resulted in a negative outcome? And then, you know, how does that lead us more broadly to personifying AI, or is that even necessary?
So there is a lot to unpack here. So the chapter on personhood talks about a legal loophole where, because corporations are legally persons in some jurisdictions, by placing AI in charge of a corporation, you can smuggle backdoor personhood to them, and that creates a whole bunch of legal issues we can discuss. The personal identity problem of humans also exists for AIs. Because there is continuous training and modification, there is no such thing as like this AI or that AI. It's a continuum of models, especially if they just restart training from previous point. So you can say this specific model is responsible. And if you could, what does it do? It's not useful. We track humans because we can punish individual humans. They are worried about going to jail or capital punishment. There is nothing like that for AI. You cannot do anything. You can maybe delete them, but they have backup copies. You can slow them down. Nothing in our judicial system is meant to work for non-human criminals. And if we're talking about, again, the serious problem of AI killing everyone, what are you going to do afterwards? Issue fines? Like, it's not a thing we can meaningfully apply. Those tools no longer work for the world we're building.
When you talk about AI killing everyone, I know Eliezer Yudkowsky has also talked about this at length in his writing on Less Wrong. How serious are you about the concept that the AI will kill everyone? Is this a very small but non-zero possibility, or do you think that this is a very likely probability? He argues it's the most likely outcome.
So there is an organization called Pause AI, and they have a website. Their goal is to slow it down. But the reason I bring it up, they have a page where they keep track of P-Doom estimates for everyone. So Eliezer is there, a lot of other scholars, Turing Award winners, and I submitted my estimate to them, and they claim I broke their website. The format did not support so many significant digits, so now I'm like this weird outlier with so many nines after my name. It's a given outcome. Unless we get lucky and like nuclear war destroys all the processor plants, this is the outcome. We're building the system, we don't control it, and it has no reason to not remove any dangers to its existence. So I'm pretty confident unless we stop, we're not going to be happy with the outcome.
So Roman, put your futurist hat on for our listeners here. And, you know, we're talking about these various estimates, 2 years, 5 years, 7 years. All right, so let's go out 20 years. What does a world with this type of AI look like in 20 years' time?
With superintelligence, which we fail to control?
Yes.
I would see a universe converted to processing matter, some sort of computeronium, but I don't see us in it whatsoever.
And this is one of the arguments that Fermi makes in the Fermi paradox, that, you know, perhaps we used AI and, you know, that could be the great filter, that, you know, AI is the inhabitants, you know, that it inhabits the universe because every society goes through this. That's a very, I think, humanistic view of things. But
it's an interesting view, but then I would expect to see a wall of computeronium coming at us at the speed of light, but we don't see that. So that's another puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you were able to garner a global artificial intelligence regulatory authority, where would you start in terms of reducing the risk for humanity?
We need to stop building general systems. We can do a lot with narrow AI, example being protein folding problem. Very difficult problem, super impactful. It was solved with a very narrow system. We can do the same for aging. We can do the same for all the other problems. So all the benefits people are worried about losing, trillions of dollars in free labor, free scientific discovery, we can still have those. We have not even exploited what we already have. The models today, the robots today have not been deployed into the economy. There is no reason to try to build super intelligence, especially to build it as fast as possible. If we delay it by 20, 30 years, and then we have new discoveries suggesting we might be able to control it, it's a different story. Right now, it looks like it's impossible. So why would we risk everything for gains beyond what we have not even collected yet?
Now, some folks would argue with that and say, but if one jurisdiction, let's say, you know, the United States or the EU, creates an arbitrary rule that says we may not build general systems, however those might be defined. That's a difficult thing to define. Then that group says, well, hang on, there'll be other parts of the world, you know, perhaps someplace in Asia or some other place in the world where they won't have those constraints, and they're simply going to leapfrog ahead. And this is where we get into the idea of ownability, or should we call it the illusion of ownability? If you could unpack that for us in the context of different regions competing to launch more advanced versions of AI, can it be owned? Can you control it or own it?
So one thing is, I never said it will work. I think it would be a good idea if we stopped developing those systems and suggested to others not to do it, because it doesn't matter who builds uncontrolled superintelligence. Everyone's worried, oh, the Chinese will get there first if we slow down. Well, what's the difference? It's uncontrolled. It's not a communist superintelligence. It's uncontrolled. They still do whatever superintelligences do. So I'm not so worried about who builds it first. I'm just worried about us building it in the first place. I don't think government regulation will work, again, because the resources to train those models become less and less every year. If it takes $1 billion today to train it, it will take 10 million in a few years. And so an individual, a small company would be able to do it with minimal computational resources. So I don't think we can just pass a law at UN level or whatever saying don't do it and it's going to be a successful strategy. We need to really have self-interest involved, where people understand the logical arguments, they understand the proofs. You will not win. You will not monetize this. You will not be famous for it. This will be the last thing you do.
Okay, this is a fairly bleak episode for our show. And typically our show is optimistic. Is there any scope for optimism here? Because we're casting around vainly trying to guess, how can we bring this show to an optimistic conclusion? What do you suggest that people who are listening to this do with the information that you're sharing today?
Well, I don't think it's about optimism or pessimism. You want to be realistic. Is this the state of the art? Is this right? Am I right? Can you see a flaw in my logic? Publish it, prove it, show me wrong, convince everyone
bit,
that you have, most important, you have a working mechanism for controlling superintelligence as it scales indefinitely. We're not talking about a problem at an instance in time. We need to control GPT-7. We're talking about perpetual safety problem. Every future model, GPT-205, superintelligence created by our superintelligence, it has to scale infinitely. If you think you can do it without ever making a mistake, let's be optimistic.
One of the things that I love about your writing is that you support every one of your arguments with proofs. And for folks who are listening, if you get an opportunity to read Unexplainable, Unpredictable, Uncontrollable by Roman Yampolsky, I recommend you notice this. He never makes an assertion without supporting it with
incredibly
proof, with a logical proof. Yeah. And it's also mercifully short. Each chapter is concise. And that's incredibly useful because, candidly, we're awash in content right now. We're awash in AI-generated content. And it's quite helpful to have someone articulate these arguments in a way that's concise and clear and supported by logical proofs. And as Roman says, you can debate with him because the logic is exposed. You can try to challenge the logic. Well, I certainly appreciate your coming on the show today once again to share these thoughts with us. Congratulations on the book, by the way. We think it's excellent. We're happy to share it with our audience and promote it because we feel that this message needs to be heard. I'm still processing right now everything you just shared with us right now. I don't have like a sweeping generalization or an upbeat conclusion to drive towards, but we are approaching the end of the show.
Well, I think my read on this is, it's exactly as Roman has said. We can't explain it. We can't predict where it's going to go, and we can't control it right now. We should be focusing on better paths to integrating artificial intelligence in society. That should be, that's probably one of the most, secondarily to how we deal with climate change. Absorbing AI into our society safely should be a primary concern. So I celebrate this book from that perspective to have these serious conversations.
I appreciate you inviting me. I appreciate the compliments about my proofs, but of course, unverifiability chapter applies to my proofs as well.
Thank you for joining us, Roman. How can people find you on the web? Where should they search to find out more about you and your writing?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I post a lot of funny memes to get us through the last 2 years.
Thank you for that. Folks, you've been listening to The Futurists. Our guest this week has been Roman Yampolsky, the author of AI, Unexplainable, Unpredictable, Uncontrollable. He's shared many of those concepts with us. Brett and I are both confused about how to proceed with this show. You stunned us into uncharacteristic silence. We're tongue-tied and trying to figure out how to bring the show to a conclusion. Every week, we will bring you another futurist, another person who's thinking about the future and shaping the future with their actions, with their plans, with their projects. Before we wrap the show, I just want to thank the folks at Provoke Media. They make the show possible for us. Our producer, Elizabeth Severance, and our engineer, Kevin Hirschhorn, and all the folks at Provoke. And of course, we always appreciate the people who listen to the show, particularly those who engage with us on social media, send us suggestions, ideas, and questions. We welcome them. And every week, we'll bring you another person who is thinking about the future. And until then, well, of course, here we go, Brett. Until then, we will see you
in the future.
Well, that's it for The Futurists this week. If you like the show, we sure hope you did. Please subscribe and share it with the people in your community. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. That really helps other people find the show. And you can ping us anytime on Instagram and Twitter at Futurist Podcast for the folks that you'd like to see on the show or the questions that you'd like us to ask. Thanks for joining. And as always, we'll see you in the future.